What does a post-COVID return to the office mean in the world of tech? We continue now with In the Moment Tech Radio. Most of us relied on our tech devices just a little extra during this past year, but what does the workplace look like as folks begin getting vaccinated and returning to the office? Yet another streaming option arises with the launch of Paramount Plus, but is it really worth it at this point? And what will it take to get me verified on Twitter? We've got a full panel list of experts ready to answer these questions and any of yours. You can submit your questions by emailing us at inthemoment@sdpb.org. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh, and a full hour of Tech Radio is coming up after the news.
With SDPB News, I'm John Nguyen. Lawmakers will delay possible impeachment proceedings against Attorney General Jason Raunsberg until court action is completed. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
House legislative leaders have stripped the articles of impeachment from their resolution. They say a recent order from a Hyde County court judge prevents them from a transparent impeachment process. The judge ruled that video interviews about the fatal crash when Raunsberg was driving had to be taken off a state website. Lawmakers say that makes impeachment impossible. Kent Peterson is the majority leader in the House. He says delaying the impeachment is appropriate given the ruling.
We're going to let the process play itself out and then reevaluate at that time. So I can't answer for or against other members of the House to think if articles will be brought forward.
Impeachment starts in the House. If there are enough votes, the Senate holds a trial to determine whether Raunsberg should be removed from office. No constitutional officer has ever been impeached before. Peterson says impeachment would require a special session, which involves a two-thirds majority vote in both chambers. The Constitution says impeachment proceedings would not count as part of the 40-day legislative session. Governor Kristi Noem says the quickest way to resolve the situation is for the Attorney General to resign.
I won't weigh in on what the legislators decided to do or how they'll proceed with impeachment. What I will say is that I still continue to believe the Attorney General should resign.
State Democrats say House Republicans are misinterpreting their role. Jamie Smith is the minority leader in the House.
It's not a legal proceeding in the courts like we think of as like a trial. It is an impeachment.
The House will vote on whether to delay the possible impeachment of Jason Raunsberg on Monday. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Pierre.
South Dakota Republicans have voted to put a constitutional amendment on the next primary election ballot that would make it more difficult to pass ballot initiatives to raise taxes or spend public funds. More people traditionally vote in general elections, and the effort to move the amendment to the June 2022 primary has drawn criticism. Democrats and some Republicans say it could head off ballot campaigns already in the works. Nonetheless, most GOP lawmakers in the House on Thursday agreed to ask primary voters to decide whether ballot initiatives should have a 60% vote requirement to raise taxes or spend more than $10 million within 5 years of enactment. Family members of Governor Kristi Noem received more than $600,000 in funds from a state grant program pushed by the governor that directed federal coronavirus relief funds to small businesses. Records on the grant program show a ranch belonging to Noem's family received one payment of $500,000. Also, a business operated by her brothers, Rock and Rob Arnold, received a payment of just over $100,000. Noem once maintained part ownership of the ranch, but her office says she no longer does. The ranch pays rent for some farmland Noem owns. For weather today, we're seeing mostly sunny skies across the state with high temperatures reaching the lower 50s in the far east to the upper 60s statewide. Later tonight, mostly clear skies west with partly cloudy skies in the east. Evening lows are in the upper 20s to the lower 30s. On Saturday, mostly sunny skies across the state with highs in the mid-50s east central to the lower 70s in the west. Up next, it's Tech Radio on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
SDPB provides comprehensive coverage of the South Dakota State Legislature all session long. Listen on SDPB Radio and to our daily podcasts. SDPB-TV presents late-night replays of the day's general session and access to the legislature live online at sd.net and on the SDNet app. SDPB's coverage grants all citizens access to democracy in action. More at sdpb.org/statehouse.
Program funding is provided by Missouri River Energy Services, working in partnership with our 61 member communities to provide energy and energy services that support citizens and help sustain local business. MRenergy.com.
SDPB brings you the South Dakota Girls State Basketball Tournament. You can catch all the action Thursday, March 11th through Saturday, March 13th. For more information, including multiple ways to watch the games live, go to sdpb.org/basketball. Complete coverage of the South Dakota Girls State Basketball Tournament is brought to you by Dakota Bank and SD Corn.
Take In the Moment with you wherever you go with the In the Moment podcast. New episodes drop every Friday and feature the best of the week from news and the arts. Download and subscribe to In the Moment wherever you get your podcasts. Science and Technology Reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
Welcome back to In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm Jackie Hendry, filling in today for Lori Walsh. Let's introduce our full panel of techsperts joining us today. I already hate that I made that pun, but we're going to roll with it. First, we welcome Amos Asap, Chief Information Security Officer at Exigent Solutions in Sioux Falls. Amos, welcome back to Tech Radio. John T. Meyer is co-founder and CEO of Lemonly in Sioux Falls. John, hi there.
Hey, Jackie. How are you?
Doing fine. Jeff Litterick is network engineer with the Bureau of Information and Technology in Pierre. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
And last but certainly not least, SDPB's social media specialist, Heather Benson. Hi there, Heather.
Hi, Jackie.
A whole lot of expertise here in one space. Feel free to email your questions to them in the moment at sdpb.org, or you can send me a tweet at Jackie Hendry SD. And speaking of Twitter, Heather, what's it going to take for me to get my little blue check mark? It went away, and now it's back. And I want it. Let's talk about the verification process.
Well, as anyone who has gone down that road in the last few years know, it went away. You could do nothing about it. And then they said, it's coming back January. I think they gave us an exact date even. And
right.
That date came and went.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wait.
But why?
Well, if you remember, it went away in that sort of aftermath of the 2016 election. And, you know, as the heat came on the social media companies to clean up their act a little bit, you know, to get rid of misinformation and deal with, you know, bot accounts that were retweeting things. And they never really gave us solid reasons why it went away. But I think we can all see that there's probably some risk on their part. Of having blue check marks maybe where they didn't belong or with accounts that weren't necessarily putting out the information that they were comfortable with. And it's kind of like, you know, when you were in first grade and somebody did something wrong and they took the, you know, activity away for everyone. No recess for all of you. There we are.
Right. Do we know?
Jackie, I'm curious. Did anything happen when you got the blue check mark? Or like they didn't actually, did they reach out to you or ask you to like, confirm your identity, or it just shows up?
I don't have it. As far as I can tell from my friends who have earned their blue check mark, I think they just kind of woke up one day and they were like, oh, cool, I'm verified now. That's neat. Which
funny.
Is rude. I've tried looking up the FAQs. They're like, okay, you need to have your real name in a certain spot. You need to have a link to your organization's website. So I added my little sdpb.org link in my bio, and here I sit blue check markless. So that's why I ask Heather. John T., are you verified? I don't remember. I haven't looked at your Twitter in a while.
I'm not.
All right.
I don't know if it's a volume thing or... Certainly, I think it makes a ton of sense to, I think, for journalists, for politicians, like people in those public roles. I would love one. I mean, I think like not so much for like I think there it's a weird, not like a vanity thing, but I think there is true value in a blue check mark, as crazy as that sounds.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much that, like, you know, Twitter followers is a vanity metric for sure, but building an audience is something that I'm a big believer in, just as like a marketing branding guy. Like, when you build an audience around whatever subject matter you're passionate about or you know best, you can always turn that into something down the road, directing that audience toward a cause, directing it toward a product, toward a service, you know, whatever it might be. So
Right. That's
the value in the checkmark.
Right. And I've been thinking about that because I never really particularly cared about the checkmark until recently, now being becoming host of South Dakota Focus on SDPB-TV, a slightly more visible role in our organization. All of a sudden, it feels to me like, oh, maybe it would be nice just to have that little extra piece of almost legitimacy added to my social media profile, so that when I throw questions out there or information out there, it's like an additional element of trust, even if I don't have SDPB next to my name.
Yep. And you touch on something important there, Jackie. As, you know, a good social media consumer, we should be looking for verified accounts when we look for good information, which brings us in, you know, a closed loop of, I want to be a good social media consumer. Everyone tells me I'm supposed to be careful what I read and who I take information from. And then we don't have a way to complete this process and make sure that certain accounts are verifiable. And while we're on air, I am actually on Twitter's verification page, where they have stripped all reference to the January 22nd, 2021 date when we'd get verification back. And it simply says there is no way to apply for verification today. And so we wait.
Ugh. Well, then I will wait with bated breath to see when I'm added to the blue checkmark club. John T. Meyer, I'm going to pivot now to something we're thinking about more and more these days. Obviously, we had a big rush to figure out how we pivot in a short amount of time to a work-from-home scenario in an emergency situation with the pandemic in its early days. Now, as more folks are getting vaccinated, we're starting to hear about the process of returning back to the workplace, and that has its own set of challenges in a way. What are you hearing about how that process is looking for office space leaders?
Yeah, I think there is the next 3-4 months is going to be really interesting. We have rolling out vaccine distribution, which is great. I think even just the warming up here in South Dakota, people might be a little more willing or interested or excited to get back to the office. This is, of course, for the offices who have been able to be remote.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think we have an interesting sort of psychological challenge ahead of us. You know, a lot of people, humans, we don't like change, but we also adapt very quickly. And so people have established a lot of new habits. They've established new routines. And I think even, you know, I've thought about it at Lemonly, we're doing great in terms of productivity, efficiency. Everybody has proven they can do their jobs just as well, honestly, if not better remotely. But there is something we're missing from a creativity collaboration standpoint. So how do I, as a leader, say, hey, you know, come back, but also, you know, if they're doing their job and they appreciate that flexibility and adaptability, like, where do I fall in terms of, it's certainly not going to be a requirement, but is it a, you know, suggested? Or I just think we have a lot of new habits that if you almost have to be proactive if you want to break them or change them. And then is it 5 days a week? Is it two? Is it 50-50? You know, I think that's a lot of questions to answer.
Right. And it's a really interesting set of questions as we kind of rethink what it means to have an office space, and as we kind of figure out how to deal with those kind of boundaries in our lives. Because I know I was thinking about this morning, this idea of I'm not working from home, I'm just living where I work now, and having trouble to make that distinction between the different parts of your day.
Yes. Yeah, we do. That is one of the hardest parts. And on my podcast back in the summer, I had a remote work expert, and she talked about the idea of really creating separation, either through physical space, if you're able, right, like a room where you can close the door, or through like routine, like you have like a kind of a wind up work routine, and then you actually have like a wind down work routine.
to your end your day, because it's very blurry between the two spaces now.
Right. Amos and Jeff, I'm going to bring you two into the conversation, because I'm thinking about another challenge from the work from home situation is kind of that network capability and the security aspect of all of that, depending on the level of information you're dealing with. As people start to some extent moving back into the workplace, how do we see some of those developments kind of carrying through in kind of the post hardest days of the pandemic world? Amos, maybe we'll start with you.
You know, there was a mad rush at the very beginning when the pandemic started and people started making their way out of the offices to get the infrastructure needed that was required to allow those users to access the network remotely, to be able to, you know, use their computer from home, to make sure that security processes and procedures that would be commonplace in an office had, you know, even a small ability to be moved remotely into people's homes or other places that they were working. And now, as people start to come back, that infrastructure is still going to be there. There was a lot of money that was spent on hardware and services and the ability for people to be remote. And so I think if there's proper planning in place, that should make it easier should this sort of event ever come up again. But there's also going to be, maybe some expenses that will, for let's say like a software subscription that they purchased for this particular type of event, do they continue that on so that they're prepared? Do they let that lapse and then have to, you know, quickly regain that subscription again down the road if they ever need it? There are a lot of decisions that need to be made there. And then, of course, coming back into the network, into the how your work environment, making sure that everything is hasn't been abandoned for a year, that things are up to date, that hardware is where it should be, that security patches have been applied, et cetera. So there are considerations that need to be taken into account when people are coming back to the office.
Jeff, what are you seeing from in how we move forward?
Well, it's not going to be like it was before. And most businesses have already stated that they don't expect their workforces to totally ever come back into the office entirely. And one thing we'll probably be seeing a lot more that I'm starting to see is more hybrid, where people are much more comfortable working at times from home when needed, but also going into office occasionally. And some companies are talking about doing swing space in the office, where they maybe only bring a third in at a time or a half of their workforce in a time, and maybe you only come into the office for 2 to 3 days and stuff. So there's a lot, and we'll see how this all works out. There's a lot of theories about this, but people are going to be still working remotely for a long time. And the companies are expecting that and are sizing their stuff right for that. So it's going to be different than before, but it'd be nice to get back in, everyone to get back in the office, the social part of it, at least, you know, on some time basis. And I think a mix is probably going to be what you're going to see going forward as the most kind of healthy work environment. So,
right.
And I guess this is where I think it gets fascinating and I don't want to make generalizations. It could be, you know, based on generations. It could just be personal preference, home life kind of situations. But I think businesses are going to have to make some tough choices between, to Jeff's point, is it, you know, what is the value of having those folks in the office? Because we now have proven to ourselves that we can almost work anywhere, which then the flip side of that means is you can work for almost anyone. And you don't have to live in the city where you work, and you don't have to be a resident of the state where your company is also, you know, headquartered. And so I think, you know, that's interesting as an employee. It's also interesting as an employer, right? The opportunity has been very much opened up.
Right. And I think there's...
Yeah, and a lot of businesses have been talking about how they're looking forward to that, because sometimes, you know, your business is in a certain place, part of the country, and you have some real talent that wants to work for you but doesn't want to move there. Well, they don't have to move there anymore. And I think what you're starting to really see, there was some backlash from some companies, but most companies are starting to accept that this works. I think a lot of companies were afraid that if their workforce was remote, work wouldn't get done and all that stuff. And that's, for the most part, been proven very much untrue. So as the companies themselves get more comfortable with it, the more options for the employees they're going to allow are opening up. So I think it's going to be a win-win in the end. But it's going to look quite different than before COVID for the normal, you know, office-type work environment.
Right. John, say a little bit more about this, especially in more creative situations with that group collaboration, how we've kind of managed in a virtual meeting space, but talk a little bit about the differences you're seeing and just how effective that kind of group collaboration is in person versus on Teams or Zoom.
Yeah, there is a lot of fascinating tools in this space that have come along the last couple of years as remote work was growing, and I think we're going to see even more in the next 12 to 18 months ahead, to people who are probably starting companies during the pandemic that we don't even know about yet. So one way that we think about it at Lemonly is moving this is the term in terms of the way you work from more of a synchronous environment to an asynchronous environment. And so what that means is synchronous is when we're all together at the same time, not necessarily physically, but like all on a Zoom call or all on a video or Slack channel, like at the same time. So one pivot we've tried to make over, you know, we're coming up on a 1 year anniversary since we've gone remote next week, is being more asynchronous. And so what that means is documenting things, using writing, recording videos. We use an awesome tool at Lemonly called Loom. It allows you to record your screen and it puts a little, your face in the corner. And so maybe instead of meeting, you and I meeting Jackie on a call to walk you through the instructions, I would instead record a quick 5 minute video, send it to you, say, hey, watch this on your own time. And then definitely like give me a call for if you have questions or you're not, it's not clear. And so by being more asynchronous, it allows you to work when and where you prefer. And, you know, if you, you don't have to apologize for, hey, my kid just woke up from their nap, if you have a young child or the dog is barking, or, you know, you can be a little bit more flexible. And so that's one shift we're trying to make. Now we still have to figure, we still definitely value those collaboration times where we can all be at least on a call together for creative reasons, but it's a good focus of ours trying to be more asynchronous.
A reminder, you can submit your own questions for our group of tech experts by emailing us in the moment at sdpb.org. You can also tweet me at Jackie Hendry SD. I'm the one without the blue check mark, but we're waiting on it. Coming up, we're going to talk some of our streaming platforms and a little bit more about that data security. You're listening to In the Moment Tech Radio on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, James McBride, best known for his memoir, The Color of Water, about being the son of an African-American father and white mother. His latest novel, Deacon King Kong, is set in 1969 in a Brooklyn housing project like the one he grew up in. His previous novel, The Good Lord Bird, was adapted into a Showtime series starring Ethan Hawke. Join us.
Tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Gene and his team of experienced insurance advisors will insure your home with your specific needs and budget in mind. GeneHufford.com.
I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear the latest from Cuban-born drummer-composer Daphnis Prieto, trombonist Marshall Jilks, and saxophonist Tom Tillich. There's also solo piano music from Chick Corea's last album, and we'll hear some classic tracks by bassist composer Charles Mingus and John Coltrane. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Underwriting SDPB Radio enhances your corporate image and projects quality and credibility. Stand out from the competition and reach a quality audience. Include SDPB Radio in your branding campaign. SDPB.org/support.
Welcome back to In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm Jackie Hendry. In today for Lori Walsh, we've got a full panel of tech experts here and ready to answer your questions. Feel free to send us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org, or send me a tweet at Jackie Hendry SD, and we'll find the answers for you. But first, kind of my own question, and I'll open it up to the group. I'm seeing headlines about Google saying they're not going to use certain ways of tracking you through those cookies that we hear about that give us those certain advertisements on the side, and we think, ew, how did they know, and it's very creepy. But Google saying they're not going to use certain third-party ways of tracking cookies. What does that mean for the world of digital advertising and our data security moving forward?
Yeah, I can take that one.
Yeah.
Basically, what Google is saying is that they're going to stop selling like web ads that are targeted to your individual users' browsing habits. And Google has a browser that they have that they've built called Chrome that's no longer going to allow cookies that collect that data. And you know, one of the obvious examples of the way those work is when you do a search for, let's say you're doing a search for a Caribbean vacation because you're looking at doing that later this year, and then all of a sudden in your Facebook feed or on Twitter, right, you're getting these advertisements that are identical to what you were searching for last night, and that's really common. And they do that because they know those ads are of a topic that you're interested in. It was something you searched for on purpose last night or whenever it was, and that is, you know, you're likely to click on it because it's a topic of interest to you. But some people find that creepy. some people find that a little bit of an invasion, that there are these advertisers who are aware of things that you're searching for privately at home. And a lot of people just don't feel comfortable with that. They feel like it's an invasion of their privacy. There are a lot of ways for you to attempt to fix this yourself. There's different pieces of software you can add into your Chrome browser. There's different ways of connecting to the internet using DNS, et cetera. But in general, if Google is going to start leading this charge, we're going to have better overall results. And honestly, you know, it's going to make people feel better about their privacy as far as who has what information about them and their searches and the places they visited on the internet.
And I'll jump in. And importantly, part of some of Google deciding to do this isn't because they're feeling altruistic and care about our feelings. They're responding in part to legislation passed in the EU and Australia and New Zealand in the last couple of years that are already restricting the way they collect information in those countries. And not that we, to my knowledge, have any active legislation that's about to take place here in the US, but I would wager to say it's a little preemptive to make sure they don't have to make major changes. And also from the back end of their system, once you have that many large groups of people, you already have to redo how you do searches, how you collect info, how you do business. It's easier just to do it the same everywhere or closer to the same than here's what I do for the U.S. and here's what I do for the EU.
How much do we expect this to impact, you know, folks who are digital advertisers, basically? I'm not sure how much that'll impact that industry. Heather, do you have any ideas?
Well, it's from what has already played out in the EU, it's impacted it to a certain degree. It impacts how you go about buying your ads and what you use for targeting your selected audience. But by and large, you're still able to get generally where you want. Maybe not quite as specific as you once did. We already dealt with this in Facebook a few years ago when about the 2016. Everything comes back 2016 on social media, where a lot of demographic info was removed from the system. But you can ask anyone who's buying ads on Facebook, are you still able to target pretty tightly? Yes. Do we expect changes to come in with all this? Yes. But there's a lot of other tools that are very sophisticated that still allow you to get where you need to be. And the market adjusts really, really rapidly.
Interesting.
Yeah, I agree with Heather there. It's definitely like a pendulum swing back and forth where either legislation or even, you know, the tech companies decide, like, this is a great move for Google, right? Because they look great and it looks like they really care and are valuing your privacy. We've talked on the show before how Apple is using privacy as sort of a, yes, because they should, but also almost like a positioning, like, hey, we're not Facebook and Twitter, you know, we value your privacy and your security. So that, you know, that things swing one way that way, and then a new tool comes out that they're able to leverage your data or information in a different way, and it kind of swings back the pendulum that way. So it is really a give and take that seems to go back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Another headline I'm seeing, I think it's Samsung and MasterCard working on a payment system based on your fingerprint. I know there's been a lot, especially when we get into these ideas of facial recognition with security and now looking more at a broader use of that fingerprint element. Amos, maybe I'll toss this one to you. Are there reasons to be excited about this or more reasons to be skeptical about something on those lines?
Well, it depends on how you feel about biometrics, right? And whether
yeah.
or not that information is available or stored or accessible by a third party. And while, you know, while MasterCard will tell you that that information let's take a fingerprint, for example.
Mm-hmm.
When a fingerprint is scanned or added to an environment, and for most people, this is going to be easiest to recognize on your phone, right? Because we have had those for a long time. There's not actually a picture of your thumbprint that's stored somewhere. It's actually turned into ones and zeros and probably a hash of some sort so that it can be stored in a semi-secure manner. And that's what MasterCard is going to tell you, that, you know, they're storing it in a secure manner. It's not actually a picture of it. It's not like it could be reused somewhere by getting it on a piece of tape or something like that. However, just having that information out there and starting to have it in more and more places starts that ball rolling of where are the security weaknesses in these areas and what are the things we don't know about that when that security issue pops up and we say, gosh, we never thought of that. Or that didn't seem like something that would happen. Those are the things that we need to try to be prepared for as much as we can. And that's why a lot of privacy folks have concerns about facial recognition or about biometrics just in general. And so the more of these things that we get into that have these sorts of security features built into them, the more that information is going to be spread out, the more databases it'll be in, the more devices it'll be in, and it can just be a concern for a lot of people.
Shifting gears a little bit, Jeff, I know you sent us a note ahead of the show about problems related to semiconductor production and demand and a whole mess of things happening there. Tell us a little bit about what you're watching on that scene.
Well, yeah, this has been kind of growing. Basically, since, like we talked about a little bit earlier, the mad rush when everyone went home from COVID and everyone had to buy cameras and devices for home users to work from home and stuff, the electronics demand went up. In fact, last year, PC sales were record highs and record highs for the past 10 years, in fact, in terms of units sold. Well, what's that been doing along with the COVID shutdowns and other stuff is it's been driving demand for the chips that make these components, be it your iPhone, be it your car, be it the sensors in your car, be it your computer, because they're all these devices are built off memory chips, CPU chips, sensor chips, and stuff like that. And they're all made in what we call semiconductor fabs. And there's only so many fabs and worldwide, with most of them being in Korea and Taiwan, with a few being in the United States and China for the actual what they call chip fabs. Well, the demand last year and this last quarter, and I'll talk about pricing going through the roof, has been 30%, the supply has been 30% below demand. there's so many people buying devices and stuff that they just cannot produce the chips fast enough. And it is helping that Taiwan, one of the major manufacturers, is having a drought. And one of the things that requires the fab plants require is a lot of water. Hmm. So the Taiwan government recently just told all their companies making chips to either slow down production and cut out all water use or just shut down.
Wow.
So this is starting to ripple through. GM in December and January have had to idle their manufacturing lines for cars and trucks because they literally cannot build the computers that need to go into those to make them run because they can't get the chips from the manufacturers. And laptops are starting to see this, especially high-end equipment that requires the very best chips and stuff, which are always produced in limited numbers because I won't get into the details, but the newer the chip, the less the yield there is. So when they make a wafer of chips, not every chip comes off the wafer good. And stuff they've been making for years tends to be all the chips come off the wafer good. Well, the new chips, the very cutting edge, like the new Apple chips and stuff, they may only get 10 good chips out of 200 when they first start this. It takes years for these processes to kind of evolve and make. So what they call yield on newer stuff is much less. So that's why newer chips always cost more, is because they can't make as many of them. And now they're not making as many of anything. And it's really driving, pricing through the roof. In some cases, I'm starting to see this last month, 350% above MSRP for some devices, be it video cards, be it high-end laptops, be it other stuff. Everything requires these chips, be it any device you get. Your USB hub requires these chips. There's even chips in your USB cables, right? It's gotten so bad that President Biden now has actually done an executive order directing the federal government to try to find some solutions to this, because it's going to have some very extreme ripples, because if you can't build the devices, you can't sell the devices through the whole industry and stuff. And anymore, with the way electronics are, it affects your washing machine. It affects your stove you want to buy, your refrigerator, because everything requires semiconductor chips.
Wow.
And the semiconductor fabs are now saying they're going to be backordered for over a year to 2 years. So this may be a long drought where we see increased pricing on all electronics for quite a while. The bigger players like Apple and Samsung, which Samsung has their own fab plants, in fact, in Korea, they can demand and get first priority. But it's like the Ford and GMs, because they do supply on demand, they're having to actually shut down production. They can't build new cars for a while because they just literally can't get the chips in. And that will apply to appliance makers and all sorts of stuff going forward. So it may be quite a while before we get out. And something to keep in mind, that pricing may be going up on a lot of stuff, and it may not come down for a while. So with anything electronic. So it's something we're kind of keeping a track of. Certain devices are already hard to get, or it's just been out of stock for like 3-4 months now, and there is no timeline on when they're going to come back in stock. It's kind of like the webcams. When everyone went home, they were out of stock literally for months and months on end. And as soon as they came in, they were sold out immediately. And it doesn't help that for like some components, especially high-end stuff, that Bitcoin is shooting up again, because that tends to drive demand on high-end computers, because that's what's used to mine Bitcoin, which makes. And when it gets to that money, people buy all the high-end computers immediately as soon as they come in stock. So it's going to put pressure on a lot of stuff. But it's kind of an interesting fallout of COVID and now a drought over in Asia that's going to impact us for a while. And just be aware, I mean, electronics are still being made. It's just that pricing may go up, and certain devices may be harder to get over the next year or so. But it's going to have some impacts on the economy. In fact, it already is. Look at the price trends for January alone, where some pricing on some stuff shot to 250% above MSRP to 350% MSRP. And it's probably going to trickle down into the lower end phones and stuff like that as time goes on, as these chips get a little bit more scarce. And demand is not slacking off from what all the estimates are saying. And this, they just can't build more plants fast. It takes about 5 years to build a fab plant. So even if they started right now to catch up with demand, it's going to be 5 years before they can catch up. So It's going to be kind of an interesting year in the electronics field for especially maybe new products being delayed and not coming out for variability. So.
Right. Well, I'm connecting a dot that I'm not sure if I should be connecting, so I'll pose it to you. My PC gamer boyfriend has been telling me a whole lot about these NVIDIA graphics cards. They're the big new thing, and no one can get a hold of them because of a supply issue. AMD is announcing graphic cards to compete with NVIDIA, saying that they can actually meet that demand. Is that tying into this whole fab and the drought and everything?
Yes. In fact, the new NVIDIA cards, you unless you were 3 seconds when they first came out, you're not getting one. and NVIDIA is actually taking steps to do this, but part of it is supply, the chip and what fabs and what chips they can get. But a large part of the video, especially the video card, is cryptocurrency and the demand. Because to make cryptocurrency, you need high-end video cards. That is and high-end computers. That is the primary ingredient to make money on cryptocurrency, to be able to produce it, without going into all the details. So what happens is, and this has it the first time it's happened to the high-end video card and even low-end now, is when the cryptocurrency gets valued up like Bitcoin does, all the crypto miners, as they're called, buy all the high-end hardware off the market. And that's part of the demand, right? And we're not feeling AMD is going to be able to meet the demand. Small practical purposes, even PS5s. PS5s came in on stock on Amazon and lasted about 3 minutes again, both models. So everything's going up in price, anything with semiconductors, and supply is going to outstrip demand for a while. I got many a friend who was trying to build a computer end of last year that they've just given up. They can't even buy pre-builts from Dell because Dell sells out so fast. That they can't even, by the time they make up their mind on the high end, the computer's already sold out.
Wow.
Probably not going to solve. Now, NVIDIA is actually trying to do this by coming out with new drivers that will make crypto mining very slow on their cards and producing new cards that are just for, that will have higher speed for crypto mining, but that's still months and months out before that becomes kind of mainstream, because people can still use the old drivers and have the full speed benefits. So NVIDIA, everyone's trying to meet this, but like I said, demand is 30% higher than the supply across the board. There's going to be a drought for probably at least 6 months to a year, even with all the new stuff going in pretty much across the board. Some of the AMD stuff may be in higher supply, but I have a feeling it's going to get, because there's so many people waiting on video cards as it is, that this is going to go out of stock for the next 6 months just as fast.
Wow. We're going to take a short break. Up on the other side, we'll talk about the new Paramount Plus streaming service and answer any of your questions. Email us at inthemoment@sdpb.org. Send me a tweet at Jackie Hendry SD. You're listening to In the Moment Tech Radio on SDPB Radio.
This week on Science Friday, the rollback of drug laws in Oregon. Are healthcare workers ready?
I would love to run around with a magic wand and cure everyone's substance use disorders by tapping them on the forehead. That's not realistic.
Plus, kids ask about teeth.
My question is, why do teeth move around so much before they fall out?
It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain.
State House coverage provided by Boyce Law Firm, building lasting relationships that transcend generations, representing a variety of industries and employment matters, including defense of workers' comp claims. Experience, integrity, community. BoyceLaw.com.
Thanks to your support, South Dakota Public Broadcasting is able to bring you live coverage of high school sports and fine arts events. We take pride in shining the spotlight on achievements of students in the classroom and on the stage. Support SDPB now and help us continue to offer high school sports championships and all-state music presentations. Donate at sdpb.org/donate. SDPB's extensive legislative coverage includes In Their Own Words. Hear debates and conversations from South Dakota's legislators. In Their Own Words is supported by SDN Communications. More at sdncommunications.com.
Welcome back to In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm Jackie Hendry. In today for Lori Walsh, we've got our full panel of experts to answer your tech questions. Send me a tweet at Jackie Hendry SD. Send us an email inthemoment@sdpb.org, and we'll find the answers for you. In the meantime, sort of a soft launch a little bit of the Paramount Plus streaming platform. It was basically CBS All Access, and until then, now kind of adding to your long list of streaming possibilities. Heather, I think maybe I'll pop to you for this one, because I'm just thinking about all the different avenues for content at this stage in the game. We had our kind of cable cutters early on, and now it just seems to be the same story in a slightly different way as we get even more streaming platforms. What's your sense of having yet still another streaming possibility to choose from?
Well, I think 2021 might be the year where we find out what the public's capacity is for options. Because, you know, the first push towards becoming a, quote, cord cutter and, you know, getting Netflix with your, say, over-the-air TV was, a lot of it was cost. You know, cable or satellite had become very expensive. You had a lot of things. You know, you get 290 channels and you only use six of them. So, it, you know, part of the conversation would be, we'll pay for what you actually use. And it's very, very easy, especially, you know, with most of these offering a 1 month free trial or 6 month free trial, or Verizon signs you up for it and you didn't even know it. you get onboarded with these things, and they're, you know, quiet little $4.99 here, $6.99 here. It's not, you know, the $140 a month you might have been paying for satellite, but once you have 10 or 12 of these services, you're paying about the same. And I think this is the year where we see people go, okay, what am I really using? What do I need to have? Because I think, and I don't think I'm alone in this, that there is a max capacity. Mm-hmm. There's only so much time in a day that people have to give to these streaming services. And then what inevitably usually comes after that is we'll start to see some of the consolidation. You know, you get little ecosystems and they build into a big ecosystem. And then someday down the road, you know, we'll cycle back out into little ecosystems when the next big thing comes along. But I think we're going to, you know, reach a point where there's only so much eyeball time available, and there's only so many dollars available, and something's got to give. And I think we'll, in the next 18 months, probably see some of these, you know, companies come back together. The ones that are truly successful and have the content to run with will be able to command a price for that partnership. And the ones that just didn't have the content to really launch will, you know, fade out. What I found interesting is we had Paramount Plus launch, but one that is growing faster than probably anyone expected is the one, I think it's Discovery Plus, that has all of, you know, the discoveries. And that one, it wasn't that paid attention to by the industry or by the news, because it's whatever, you know.
Right.
It's all the TLC and the Discovery shows. But that one's actually gaining subscribers as quickly as some of the bigger launches like Disney Plus has.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, my own viewing habits, and in the early days, Netflix, it's like, oh, you've got The Office and Parks and Rec and all these great things that I used to binge all the time and just have on in the background. And now those titles are chunking out into their original networks streaming service. And at that point, I'm just thinking, well, I can't do a $5 subscription for 15 different things. So maybe I'll just buy the series on a DVD set and be done with it.
Do you have a DVD player?
Well, yeah, I suppose maybe I should say a Blu-ray or something. And even then, I realize I'm in the minority with actually having a physical copy of something. So
yeah, I remember, and this has been a while. I mean, my wife and I have been married for seven years. I remember our photographer gave us a DVD with the photos after our wedding, and we looked around the house. We didn't even have a device that would play a DVD. And that was 7 years ago. We definitely don't now. So,
yeah,
I think Heather's right. You're going to see between you know, I know a lot of families that do the, hey, how about you buy Hulu, I'll buy Netflix,
yeah,
you buy Disney Plus, and we'll all share logins. And even some of those tools just realized, screw it, we'll just let you have multiple users anyway because they know you were already doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're going to see people just continue to, like, join and cancel, depending on what show they're into right now or which product is, you know, popular. So it's a huge competitive space.
Right. Jeff, you were about to jump in there.
Well, you're not the only one. I do have a 4K Blu-ray, and I still watch all my favorite movies on that because it's still much better definition than streaming off any of the services. Yeah, even the ones that offer 4K. But there's just so much original stuff that's only on the streaming. Like WandaVision is finishing up today with its season on Disney Plus.
Yes.
And I've been a big fan of that. There's no way to get that except through that streaming platform. So as you get more of these original shows, Amazon has a whole bunch of them. Netflix has a whole bunch of these originals that are all good and people want to see. But they're so fragmented, it kind of does force you into the subscribe and cancel, just because you do want to see all this original stuff, and there's just no other way to see it.
Right.
So,
yeah, and it's a fair point. Yeah, go ahead, Heather.
And I think one of the things that is likely because of our consumer habits to do the subscribe and cancel game is there will be a bigger push by these companies to lock us into a contract. I mean, the attraction for any company to get you in a contract is you can't do that. They don't want you to pop in and out. They want that assurance of your $6.99 a month for the next year, that they can, you know, project earnings and they can run their stock price and they can run their business based on knowing what their user base is going to be. When we all pop in and pop out based on what we feel like watching, that becomes much more difficult. And thus far, it's been there's not a lot of push to make subscribers because of the way the competition was heading. But the more players you get in the field, and the more we as consumers pop in and out because it's convenient for us, the more likely I see it is that they're going to make it very attractive, be it monetarily, or just the only option you have to lock in at a subscription for 6-12 months at a time.
Hmm. One thing that I think we'll find interesting is what is the pain point on pricing for some of these? Because you have some, and like the Paramount Plus, they're going to have a cheaper option in the future, but they're actually almost as high as Netflix is. Disney Plus by itself without the bundle and stuff is fairly cheap. Discovery Plus is fairly cheap and stuff. And I have a feeling that like the Paramount pricing is a bit too high for that monthly. I'm not going to spend $11 a month on Paramount Plus for sure. Mm-hmm. When I can get a lot of, and I enjoy a lot of the original stuff on Disney, but it's much cheaper, right?
Right.
Where, you know, and the companies are going to have to figure out where their pricing option. I know Paramount Plus is going to have like a $7 option in June, because I think they're still trying to explore this too. How much of a price are people also willing to pay for the content? So that would be kind of fascinating to see, as there might be a rush to the bottom a little bit to gain some numbers and stay alive and see what happens with the pricing.
Right. And another thing I'm noticing with a whole bunch of these streaming platforms is you've got, the $9.99 a month, which is the more expensive option, but you can go down to $5.99 a month and then you'll have commercials. So kind of weighing that price point of are you willing to have a bargain and then continue to be advertised to while you're watching whatever it is you're watching or not? So that's a whole nother layer to the calculations that people have to do.
I think the one nice thing of the consumer is we continue to get great content, because Jeff's right, like those exclusive shows are so valuable.
Right.
Everyone wants to make those new shows that are exclusive to their platform. I think you're seeing with Disney is having a ton of success because you're recognizing the value of the IP, like the characters, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your Marvel, your Star Wars, your, you know, Disney princesses, that they can continue to iterate and make new shows but still use those familiar characters. And that's really why they're doing really well.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Disney's coming out with more streaming only original content in their Marvel movie verse than they are in the movies, or even plan to for the next 3 years now. Between Star Wars and Marvel, there's like 14-15 projects they have coming out that are going to be streaming original content only, and there's only like 6-7 movies total.
Right.
So So they're seeing big value in this. And one thing I want to mention is maybe the companies will start lowering pricing up where they find the customers are not so willing to swap all the time or subscribe and cancel for the original content. If they get it to a price point that the consumers, okay, I don't care this month. I'm not going to watch it, but I'm still paying $2-3 or $4 for that month. So it'll be kind of interesting how this comes out because I think you're right. The companies want a steady stream, but they're not going to. It's going to be dependent on the pricing paying for the consumers and how many they have to subscribe to, where that is all going, when they're going to be willing to lock in, so to speak.
Amos, I have a query for you as I'm thinking about we're juggling. If you're a person that's juggling a whole bunch of different streaming options, more than likely you're going to be like me and think I'm going to have break that rule and have basically the same password for everything. And everything is under the same username and password just so I can remember all these different things. And then every once in a while we do see those security breaches with credit card information and things like that. Are there maybe different or what kinds of security questions should we as consumers have as we're looking at juggling all of these different subscription services?
Well, you know, there's very limited things or limited information that we would be able to get from the providers as far as the security implementation that they would have. You're going to have to hope that they are doing their best to keep that information secure, whether it's credit card or personally identifiable information, et cetera. And they certainly have a reason to, right? I mean, they when there's a breach, it's embarrassing for them. They have to pay compensation depending on what happened and what information was leaked and whether there's any issues with credit or those sorts of things. So they've got a reason to be doing that. But back to what you said, we do see a lot of people using that same password over and over and over again. And as a rule of thumb, that's just a bad idea because if you certainly the question is, well, what are they going to do if they get into my Paramount Plus account that I should be so scared of? And it's not necessarily that account. It's just if you begin to make that a habit and you start using it across other accounts as well, when one becomes hacked, then the rest are all susceptible to being infiltrated as well. So you don't want to do that. And it's just making good cybersecurity choices across the board, making it a habit and continuing it through with all of your accounts. That's the best idea.
We're going to have to leave it there for now. We are out of time for Tech Radio this week. I want to say a big thank you to our guests, Amos Asip, John T. Meyer, Jeff Litterick, and Heather Benson. Thanks, everyone. I'm going to go home and watch WandaVision before I get spoiled. So join us again on Monday. SDPB reporters Lee Strubinger and Seth Tupper join me for our legislative roundtable. For producers Chris Loffrey, Steve Zwemke, and Josh Heyer, I'm Jackie Hendry in for Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.